Okay,
Bye.
Dr. Funk, continuing with you. So based on all your studies, we're using the word whole food plant-based, but are there some that are more anti-cancer preventing than others? Are there top foods that are the most powerful in preventing or dealing with cancer in terms of the plant-based world?
There definitely are. And if you didn't see my lecture, I have these top 18 anti-cancer foods that in the science are able to, in part, not completely, thwart the mechanisms by which cancer grows and proliferates and then metastasizes. My very top recommendations to get inside your body in some way every single day are broccoli, particularly broccoli sprouts, which have 100 times the sulforaphane content of broccoli. Broccoli lightly steamed or raw. You can have your roasted broccoli if it's your favorite food on planet Earth, as it is mine. So you roast broccoli, and if you don't know this tip and trick, so the enzyme myrosinase that converts your isothiocyanates into the magical sulforaphane, it's not naturally in the food. It is the combining of the myrosinase enzyme that then transforms the precursor into the magic, right? When you cook the food, you destroy the enzyme, you have no magic. So all you have to do is on your roasted broccoli, chop up a few florets, a couple tablespoons worth of raw broccoli. You could also use any other cruciferous vegetable, which has its intact myrosinase, such as some arugula or kale, raw, and or mustard. Whole grain mustard or mustard seed powder will do the trick. Long story, longer broccoli. Okay, cruciferous veggies, but broccoli's king and sprouts are the crown. Next up, flax seeds. 1 tablespoon of ground flax seeds every single day. Throw it in your daily smoothie if you're having it, or throw it on oatmeal if you're having that for breakfast. Maybe toss it on a salad. It just gives a little nutty flavor to it. Mix it in rice. It's pretty easy to sneak your flax daily into your meals. Number three is soy. So this shocks some people. If it does surprise you, Google my name and soy, and I think some of my PowerPoint presentations might show up because there's strong, strong science. Every single human study ever done looking at breast cancer and soy shows an absolute protective effect for the vast majority. And for those that don't show a statistically significant protective effect of soy, it's neutral. Like, it's never, ever, ever been shown to cause cancer unless you're a rat, which we aren't. So soy comes in fermented forms that may be more digestible to you. Tamari, tempeh, miso, natto, and then lightly processed soy milk, tofu, soy nuts, soybeans, tofu it up. Those are my top three, vying really like neck and neck with berries. The procyanidins and other phytochemicals in berries have such a strong association with decreasing cancer risk, but also Alzheimer's risk, improving cognition. So berries are pretty darn critical, as are mushrooms. Mushrooms are potent aromatase inhibitors. Aromatase is an enzyme in your fat that's making excessive estrogen. And get this, a tiny 10-gram piece of, it's one half basically of a button mushroom a day decreased breast cancer by 64% in a huge group of Chinese women, and followed for like 10 years. So mushrooms and the lowly white button beat out all of the expensive like portobello and crimini and la la la. Okay, so white button mushrooms. And then, so I have that top 18, but one spice that I'll just throw out, I'm not sure if we qualify spice as food, but turmeric. Turmeric really has such potent anti-inflammatory properties that it's a must get inside your cells every day.
Do you have any thought on, there's a professor, Thomas Seyfried at Boston College, that says the core that the food of cancer is glutamine and glucose. And because of that, he's saying to avoid sugar. And then some other people, Brian and Anna Marie Clement and Gabriel Cousins, are taking that and saying you should avoid fruit if you're sick at all, because it feeds yeast, mold, fungus, and cancer. So when you have a healthy patient, would you tell them to limit fruit? And if you have a cancer patient, would you tell them to limit fruit?
Never limit fruit. Have as much intact whole fruit as your heart desires, diabetic or not, cancer or not. Does cancer eat sugar? Yeah, of course it does. It's a cell, and its only real fuel is glucose. And so Seyfried, his theory basically postulates that cancer cells rely almost exclusively on glucose for their energy. And therefore, you can make these dietary changes that severely reduce carb intake and therefore glucose availability, and you can effectively, quote unquote, starve your cancer cells. And that may be true, actually, because what uses sugar the most needs it, it's faster. So cancer cells inherently divide faster than your normal cells. So they use more sugar than your normal cells. But if you effectively starved your entire body and your cancer of sugar such that the cancer cells died, you would die because your body requires sugar. And literally your red blood cells and your 30% of your brain cells demand it. They're like, keep your ketone bodies. We are only using glucose around here. We will break down perfectly good muscle in a process called gluconeogenesis just to make our crack, our glucose. We will do it. And so now you're going to start breaking down your healthy body parts. But he's not wrong. And he's got something going on there to say that, because basically the mitochondria are like these powerhouses of the cell. They create the energy for us. But when you have, when you, the he's his theory is that mitochondria produce energy by fermenting glucose and glutamine. And when you ferment these as a cell, as a cancer cell, to create your energy, you produce reactive oxygen molecules. And so that's oxidative stress, right? And now we're back to the beginning. Like, this is what cancer thrives and survives on. It loves the chaos of oxidative stress. So now this fermentation that the mitochondria are doing are promoting further uninhibited cancer cell mutation and proliferation. On the flip side, ketone bodies, right? So he's a proponent of a ketogenic diet, but we've already talked about the limitations and the lack of long-term sustainability of a ketogenic diet for most people, and or at least leading to other things that kill you. So yay, you starved your cancer and it shrunk, but oh, sorry about that heart attack that put you in the casket. You look thinner though. So he's saying ketogenic diet, what's happening there? This is smart. I mean, it could be true, and it could be used in a limited setting and along with other therapies, right? We can't completely in every case get away with shunning surgery, even radiation, chemo, anti-estrogen therapies, immunotherapies. These tools are in our toolbox, and they are effective weaponry again and when judiciously used. Ketone bodies, right? So your ketogenic diet, guess what? You don't have glucose, so it's not flying around. Ketone bodies are. And guess what cancer does with ketone bodies? Spits it out like, I'm not using that. And it's too stupid to know that it has to or it will die. So it dies. And that's the theory behind all of that metabolic theory of therapy, that you go ketotic. And in the absence of glucose and glutamine, the cancer cells literally starve. And healthy cells are like, I'll take the ketones, bring it on. So you're okay. Your healthy cells use ketones, except, like I was saying, 30% of your brain and your red blood cells. And so you're going to probably lose a little lean mass in the process. Not a bad trade-off if you are truly starving and killing cancer.
Okay, thank you. Dorothy, would you like to ask a question, and where are you from?
Yeah, hi. I'm Dorothy from New York, and I wanted to make sure I understood some of the comments that were made about intermittent fasting. I think it was said that fasting up to 16 hours is a good thing, but that skipping breakfast was not a good thing. So my question is, if I were to stop eating at 8 o'clock at night, and let's say I woke up at 8 in the morning, that would be 12 hours of fasting. Is it beneficial for me to fast 4 more hours until noon, or is that considered skipping breakfast and is bad? I'm a little confused on that point.
Thank you for asking that question, because that would be unanswered, so therefore confusing. I think the data, as I interpret it now, is that skipping breakfast is bad, and breakfast would be defined as eating it basically before 11 a.m. So you could, for two reasons, for that reason of extending longevity, shift your window backwards a bit. Instead of stopping at 8, stop at 6, and you can have breakfast 16 hours later, which is 10 a.m., which makes it into the breakfast window, right? And you can also realize that calories are not the same depending on what time of day you're eating them. I mean, it kind of just stands to reason. If you front load your calories in the day, you're moving and grooving all day long. You're doing things, you're running around, even if you're just house cleaning and chasing kids, like you are moving, right? So those calories get utilized. You have the same, I'm not even talking like, you know, mindless bag of chips and crackers kind of eating on the couch at night while you're watching your favorite Netflix. Literally, you could have a beautifully healthy but caloric meal with some whole grains and roasted veggies and some grilled tofu, but you're woofing it down at 8, 8:30, 9, and then going to bed at 10. Those are wasted, like they're not getting used by anybody. They're just getting stored then as glycogen and then as fat. So it would behoove you probably on both fronts to shift your eating window to stop earlier in the day and then to also manage to get some breakfast in.
Wendy, would you like to ask a question or where are you from?
Yeah, hi, Stephen. This is Wendy. I'm in Boca Raton. And I have two questions. One of them is about the mammogram because I haven't had one in many years. And so I recently went to the gynecologist and she said that the radiation is different now. It's not dangerous. And then I also asked about thermography and I was told that it doesn't, it's not effective. It doesn't really find anything. So that's one question. And then another one is I recently went to a conference. It's called Low Carb USA, and they're medical doctors that deal with people that are either have heart issues, diabetes, or obesity. And I talked to a number of people there. They're strictly carnivore or keto. And I mean, they say they've lost a lot of weight and they don't even eat vegetables. By the way, I eat a lot of vegetables, so I'm on your plan. But I don't understand how they have such great outcomes and they feel great and they've been doing it for years. So those are the two subjects. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Wendy. So on the subject of mammograms, unfortunately, radiation has gotten maybe a little worse and not better or safer. And the reason is 3D mammography, which is our latest and greatest. It was FDA approved in 2011. It replaced the 2D mammogram in most centers. And the 3D mammogram has more radiation than the 2D. However, it also has 17% fewer callbacks for false positive findings, and it finds 34% more cancers when going head to head against 2D mammograms. So radiation is ever present and actually increasing. Oops. And it does, in fact, cause breast cancer. So when people say, like, what do you think about mammograms? It's always difficult for me. I have to individualize it to what their story is, what their concerns are, because they're not wrong. However, I'm a numbers girl. So if you take every 10,000 people doing lifelong mammograms beginning at age 40, you're going to find about, for every 10,000 women, 860 cancers. You are going to cause 8.6 cancers from the radiation from all those mammograms. So we will find and treat 100 times more cancers than we cause with our standard of care use of mammograms. The bigger, more salient question, in my opinion, is, okay, it sounds good to find all these cancers, but now we're into overdiagnosis and overtreatment. So you just, you know, every nail needs a hammer. Are we just surgery, radiation, chemo, anti-estrogens, et cetera, on every single cancer? There are ways to dissect the biology of a cancer and be more single about our approach. You don't need all of these tools. However, people are overtreated. In one estimate, for every all the DCIS, it's stage zero, never going to kill you cancer, but could if you leave it there and it evolves. Long story short, we end up doing like 4,000 unnecessary mastectomies every year because we find too much DCIS that's never going to harm someone in her lifetime. So I have this love-hate thing with mammograms, and I can see why maybe you haven't got one, you said, in many, many years. But as I was saying, the bigger question is, how many lives are saved by doing mammograms? How many mammograms are, how many cancers, excuse me, do we have to find in order to save one life? So it actually becomes a statistical model kind of thing. But one model from England calculated that for people doing regular mammography, we save 312 lives for every one life that is lost because of the radiation-induced breast cancer. Another model was less. We save 60 lives for every one life lost because of the radiation-induced. So it's individualized. Mammo is still the gold standard. I don't like thermograms. I wish I did. Every 5 years or so, I re-dive into the new literature to see if it's ready for prime time. And it never is, unfortunately. The problem is I've just seen it all. I don't get mad at people who do thermograms, and I'm happily looking at their reports and then trying to hunt down anything weird with ultrasound. But the truth is, I've seen it miss some whoppers of cancers. Like, the entire breast is literally a basketball of cancer protruding through the skin, and the thermogram said it was fine. So it has to do with heat patterns, and sometimes we just get tricked by the interpretation of those patterns. It could just be fibrocystic nothingness, extra blood flow, hormonal fluctuation, or sometimes the whole breast can be tumor. So you have to do a clinical exam too, because it's going to have an even heat pattern. Okay, so that's mammos and thermography. Your next question was, all of these people, how do they get away with it? They're happily chomping down on bacon and burgers, and they look thin, and their skin is glowing, and they look healthy. And I think we kind of address this, at least to the extent that I am concerned about those people. And you say they've been doing it for years, and yet, and they're you know, proclaiming such health. And I'm not saying that in a air quotes way, that I don't believe that they feel healthy. My question is, are they healthy? So back to the gold standard testing on the insides of them. How are they doing? What is their coronary artery calcium score? Because I bet they have some plaque buildup despite the drop in LDL cholesterol. What is their oral glucose tolerance test? Because I bet their body is going to shoot through the roof with insulin when you spike their glucose, even though their hemoglobin A1C looks okay. So they are probably not going to have the longevity that you're seeking.
Dr. Funk, we really appreciate you sharing this information. How do people stay in touch with you, follow up, get your book? What's the best way?
Please follow me on Instagram at Dr. Kristi Funk, D-R-K-R-I-S-T-I Funk, and go to pinklotus.com, where you will find not only our brick and mortar contact info for the Breast Center, where I'm happy to do Zoom consultations, in-person consultations. You'll also find links to our Elements store, which is one of the world's most robust women's online health stores as it pertains to breast health before, during, or after diagnosis. Tons of really personally, like, I crafted a few of these with my nutraceutical guru. These products are very well vetted in the science and are always vegan. Finally, Power Up. It's my online community that is just bursting with ways to connect, to educate. You can find my Cancer Kicking Summit there, which is put on annually in multiple cities across the country. This particular year, there are two in October in Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Palm Springs, California. So I hope to see you online or in person soon.
Is your Cancer Kicking Summit online?
There is a virtual downloadable summit that's already pre-recorded, and the live ones have to be in person.
Okay. And if someone really just wants to get all their facts straight, is the best thing to do a personal consultation with you? Like, what would be the first thing if someone says, I heard a lot of stuff, but I'm not sure I absorbed everything and I want to get clear? Should they get your book? Should they do a consultation? Should they go to your Cancer Kicking Summit? What's the best thing to do?
I think you should do it all, ladies. But honestly, the cheapest, most thorough thing would be to get the book and then read it cover to cover, because you and I can't even delve that deep in an hour consultation. But if you have very personal issues that you want, you know, target addressing and looking at something very specific, then contacting the Breast Center through the website pinklotus.com and asking for a consultation is probably the best way. And of course, I'd love to see you at the summit, which is going to be packed with powerful info on how to transform your life from head to toe, from your heart to your head. You don't want to miss it.
Can we unmute so everyone can say thank you themselves?
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sylvester.